Did I see you down in a young girl's town with your mother in so much pain? I was almost there at the top of the stair with her screaming in the rain. Did she wake you up to tell you that it was only a change? Fill your cup with the promise of a man. Did I see you walking with the boys, though it was not hand in hand? And was some black face in a lonely place where you can understand? Did she wait of a man. Dream up, let me fill your cup with the promise of a man. Dream up, let me fill your cup with the promise of a man.
Maurizio Bianchi behind us right now, playing the Clockwork Orange soundtrack, by which I believe that means he's got the record on the table and he's dropping the needle around. Maurizio Bianchi plays the Clockwork Orange. Kelly Stoltz from a Mojo magazine compiled revisitation of the Neil Young album Harvest, called Harvest Revisited. And it was Kelly Stoltz taking on the title track. Magnetic Fields before that from Holiday to Desert Island, coming out of new music from Zola Jesus, the Valusia EP, Sea Talk, the name of the track we heard. Forest Swords is new music. Dagger Paths is the name of the CD EP, from which we heard the lead-off cut entitled Miarches. Hans Joachim Rodelius from 1979, Grosses Wasser, Brighton Grad 20, name of the track. Winter Drones before that, from Blood in the Coffin, a new CD. Death Moon Reprise, what we heard. DuckTales have a new CD. It's called 3 Arcade Dynamics. A track we heard called The Razor's Edge. That preceded by Vincent Over the Sink, which is one half of Naked on the Vague. A track called Book Dust. CD called Dust, or 7-inch, sorry, called Dust Studies. Opal the great Opal from a collection of early recordings entitled Such. The track we heard, Grains of Sand. And we opened that set with new music from Helado Negro, Awe Owe, name of the CD, Espuma Negra, name of the track we heard. And that is everything we heard. My name is Scott. Been a joy to be with you each and every Monday. We're together. I'll see you next week. Stay tuned. Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information is next. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org. See you next week.
I can't recall the exact moment I decided it was my destiny to become a philosopher, but I think it was sometime on the evening of December 10th, 1992. It was snowing and I was hard at work on a term paper. I was using Maurice Blanchot's book, The Writing of the Disaster, as a lens to explore Peter Greenaway's film, Drowning by Numbers. Or maybe it was the other way around. I don't remember anymore. But I do recall the decisive moment. Do I keep writing, or do I go to my job at the dollar store? Eventually, Al, the manager of the dollar store, called me up. I told him that I had decided to dedicate myself to philosophy. 2 years later, I flew from Bozeman, Montana to New York City. I was a deadly serious 22-year-old. I was going to study Nietzsche and Kierkegaard at the New School with Professor James Miller. Well, at least that's what I hoped was going to happen. I did have to get accepted into the PhD program, which is why I went to New York. I was certain that when my hero James Miller took stock of me, he would see that I was meant for philosophy, and that he would be eager to take me on as one of his students. I did, after all, read his biography on Michel Foucault twice. But, well, that's not what happened. When I told him that I wanted to spend the next 8 years studying Nietzsche with him, he pretty much laughed at me. And when he found out I didn't speak German, he laughed even more. Obviously, it was a very traumatic experience, so I'm sure I've blocked some of it out. I think he asked me why I wanted to live the philosophical life, and I think I responded with something like, because I'm not good at anything else. In the end, he was very frank with me. He told me he was certain that I was not cut out for his graduate program. I wandered into Washington Square Park, tears streaming down my face. It felt like the whole world had turned against me. Even the drug dealers were taunting me. Smoke, smoke, pussy. Smoke, smoke. But there was one other thing that James Miller said to me. And it might sound silly to you, but at that moment, it meant the world to me. He said, "It's not like you have to stop reading and thinking if you don't go to grad school." So, James Miller's just written a new book. A biography of 12 philosophers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Seneca, Augustine, Montaigne, Descartes, Rousseau, Kant, Emerson, and Nietzsche. The book is called Examined Lives, and it's probably one of the most inspiring books about philosophy I've ever read. And so, I've invited James Miller to come onto the program so we could once again talk about what it takes to live the philosophical life. All 12 of the philosophers in your book have dedicated themselves in one way or another to the Delphic question, know thyself. But you seem less interested in the answers that they come up with to the questions of who I am and how should I live, but rather you seem to want to examine how these men live with their ideas. Can you talk about why biography is so important to you?
Well, you ended by asking a question about me as an author, so I'm going to answer it as from my standpoint as an author. As I look back, for whatever reason, as a young man growing up, coming of age in the 60s, I was obsessed with the intersection of existence and broad historical political currents. And like many people of my generation, I was fascinated with psychoanalysis. I avidly took courses on French existentialism. I read Nietzsche. And I ended up writing a dissertation that was in part on Jean-Paul Sartre, who in Being and Nothingness, towards the end of that interminable book, he has a little section where he talks about a sort of a thought experiment of doing an existential psychoanalysis, which would be a recounting of one life showing how the universal emerges through the concrete particulars of a given life, which is a project that Sartre himself subsequently pursued most infamously in the unfinished big biography on Flaubert. So my interest in these topics goes back there. On the other hand, as I wrote in the preface and conclusion, I also realize if I look in my own formation that it was really important that I had a very pious, serious Lutheran mother who made certain that I was confirmed in the Lutheran Church. And so I was force-fed the idea of introspection and thinking about what you believe as being the sine qua non of a good life. And I took it, I can see in retrospect, very, very earnestly, so that the first semester I was in college, I remember reading Hume's Dialogues on Natural Religion and deciding that really I couldn't take the Eucharist because if I didn't believe in it anymore. And so this distressed my mother to no end. But in retrospect, I see that's such a Lutheran thing to do, that you couldn't – it's immoral in some way to go through the motions of rituals and liturgies you don't actually believe in. So the idea of trying to harmonize and make consistent what you actually believe with what you do was something that I was taught on the lap of my mother. And it has profound religious roots in the Western tradition, as I hope I show in the book.
Yeah. But would you say, though, for those maybe unfamiliar with the way philosophy is taught today, that this contextuality is normal or?
Well, philosophy has evolved, particularly in the modern research universities in the West, into a fairly technical a discipline that has quasi-scientific pretensions. Particularly in fields like logic, semantics, it's very, very rigorous, and many of the debates and arguments that are held would really not be of great interest to most ordinary people. At the same time, the history of philosophy has kept a tenuous grip as part of the curriculum in philosophy departments, particularly Jesuit and religious philosophy departments. But even there, it's really taught as a sequence of great thinkers who are memorialized in sacralized scripture. And so there is a long tradition of close reading of philosophical texts, which is at the heart of the way the Christian West handed down and preserved the philosophical tradition. And because it's so focused on the text and on exegesis and on also pulling out arguments and testing them to see whether they hold up, it's over the years tended to bracket the question of the life that was actually led, even though for first 2,000 years of the history of philosophy, how the life that was actually led was constitutive of philosophy. So the first half of my book is really trying to resurrect in the form of stories a neglected, very traditional way of looking at philosophy that has all but disappeared in the modern research university.
So why these 12?
Well, in a way, it's arbitrary. There were certain people I knew that I had to include, like Socrates, and I always thought I would end with Nietzsche because I had already written books about 20th century philosophers, most relevantly my book on Foucault, which takes a biographical approach to interpreting his life work. And I vacillated in what I was going to do. To start with, I planned the book to be only about philosophers who the whole point of their philosophy was to live their life in a certain manner. And I became convinced that if I did that, I would be evading and avoiding the obvious countercurrent that goes all the way back to the ancients of philosophy as a form of pure research and contemplation that's much closer to mathematics and science than it is to existentialism. So I reluctantly found myself doing research on Aristotle and Descartes and Kant because they were sort of major signposts along the way. I thought about doing Spinoza. I thought about doing Hume. Marx at one time seemed to me like he would be an interesting person to have added to the list. But I was also trying to create a kind of balance between the ancients and the moderns. So I ended up with six of each. And there's a certain amount of arbitrariness of the list, although as I write in the preface, I do include three figures that normally would be considered quite marginal in most histories of philosophy: Diogenes the Cynic, Seneca, Montaigne, and Emerson. That's four. But most of them, you know, Seneca and Montaigne and Emerson are usually treated as literary characters, and Diogenes nobody knows what to do with. So he was always going to be in because he was kind of a limit case for philosophy as a way of life.
Yeah, but I found some of these stories incredibly inspiring, more so than perhaps, you know, some of the texts that, if I think back to some of, you know, the classes I took when I was, you know, a student, especially with Descartes. You say he was a someone maybe you were forced to include, but, you know, when I, again, thinking back to some of those classes, I found it really impossible to get into Descartes, but I think the chapter in your book, you know, wow, he really led an incredibly interesting life. And, you know, although your hint of his female automaton companion certainly makes me want to know more there, but what was really exciting was sort of the backstory to his famous moment of revelation.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems that there was what he wrote publicly, and then there was a part that he kept private in this dream journal that he never let out of his sight.
No, he turns out to be quite an extraordinary person. And I did find my views on Descartes changing as I wrote about him, because I had been raised on a very negative portrait of Descartes because he basically is libeled by Martin Heidegger in Being and Time. And ever since then, people who come out of a Heideggerian tradition, Dick Rorty would do this routinely, Bert Dreyfuss and Sean Kelly do it in their new best-selling book, All Things Shining. They just trash Descartes. He's the philosophical source of the mind-body separation, and it's the beginning of the end, and egoism, and God knows, all of these other terrible things are imputed to him. But if you put him back into the actual context, it becomes a much, much more complicated story. What was surprising to me and made him interesting was the fact that the genesis of his own commitment to strict physical scientific inquiry grew out paradoxically of a sequence of dreams. And the dreams were of tremendous importance to him. And he kept a little private notebook, which he carried with him wherever he went, sewed into a jacket. And he made certain that it was passed down with his other private papers, which he was unwilling to publish during his lifetime. And he recorded this sequence of three dreams. He took them to be divine revelation. And it then struck me as I was reading these dreams and thinking about this that this presented a big problem for him, because how do you know that a dream is from God? Because maybe it could be demonic. And that was a big issue in during the period of the wars of religion as to what was the real God, who had access to the real God, how did you know, et cetera, et cetera. And in the course of thinking about and doing the research on it, I realized it was even worse for him because he was writing at a time of very publicized burnings and executions of witches. And Jesuits, he'd been trained by Jesuits, had this whole sort of discussion about how the devil could appear in the form of divine illumination. So to make a long story short, Descartes famously later raises the possibility that he could have been deceived by a malevolent demon. And sometimes people, including Michel Foucault, Foucault take this to be a gesture. It's not really meant seriously, and it seems to me, this is a serious problem for Descartes, and the reason he would never publicize the dreams is this had to be a worry for him, but he never let them go because in his heart of hearts he believed actually that he had received a divine revelation about what path in life to take, and so it was a powerful motivator for him. You know, the real drama of his life on the run, he's like a fugitive from religious persecuting forces, and it becomes really clear that, you know, his primary interest is in physical research, and that he finds himself trapped in a world in which there's this sort of forced Christian framework that he constantly has to be positioning himself against.
But he's very good at that. In fact, I don't even know if fugitive seems to be the right word. It seems like he was really successful at recognizing the obstacles that stood in the way of leading a philosophical life and planning accordingly.
Yeah. I mean, on the other hand, it seems to me there is a little streak of paranoia there. There's something just a little odd about the whole thing, that we don't know enough. It's, you know, far enough in the past, although we certainly have a lot more documentation for his life than for Socrates. But we still don't know a lot about what made him tick. And it's one of those things that the scarcity, the paucity of the record is in part obviously deliberate because of a fear. If you were to fully reveal and say honestly what you think, that you would be burned at the stake or censored.
But can you talk about maybe one or two of the things he did, sort of the safeguard that he kind of carved out this space for himself?
Well, I think that the smartest thing he did to protect his research was just to go and live in a very remote area of Scandinavia and keep to himself, by and large. That he was successful at. He hid himself.
And a couple of the individuals in your book seem to take that approach. Even Kant, you know, it seems like Kant had really kind of carved out a space for himself, you know, with his own routines and his own sort of safeguarding a space to live quietly the philosophical life.
Well, the philosophical life as he came to construe it, I think there's a kind of pathos in the case of Kant. He's, of all the people in my book, he's the one who becomes the most fecund and productive, the latest in his life. I mean, he's really in late middle age at the time he publishes the Critique of Pure Reason. And then there's this period of about 15 years when just books and essays are pouring out of his hand and brow or whatever. But he, it seems to me that the price he paid is that he lived a life that was completely dedicated to thinking, lecturing, and writing. And there was not much else to his life apart from that. So there's a kind of obscure text in Kant where he refers to people who are not rounded individuals, and he criticizes what he calls artists of reason because they're not living a full life. And, you know, my sense is that Kant, his productivity came at the cost of turning himself into an artist of reason, and very one-sided.
You know, there's another quote you also put in there early on in his life where he says, this really jumped out at me, he tells one of his students that it's better to be a fool in style rather than a fool out of style. But I felt that this really explained, you know, how later in his life, how easy it was for him to make the decision to sort of capitulate to King Frederick II in that letter that he writes.
Well, I think that, you know, a recurrent theme in even just the 12 lives I tell here is that for anybody who wants to think, it's simply a fact that often thinking is easier to do in solitude and that you need some leisure and you need some peace and quiet. And therefore, if you're somebody who's interested in thinking, which most of my people much of the time were, you will highly prize peace and quiet, and you will make compromises to make sure your peace and quiet gets protected.
So would you say that both Kant and Descartes are successful examples of living up to the Socratic maxim, which is so central to your book, actions are more reliable evidence than words?
Well, no, actually, I don't think Descartes sort of in the middle here, because I think he, in his own mind, saw his life as being exemplary, which is why he does recount an autobiography in the Discourse on Method. But Kant never, you know, I think there's maybe five autobiographical references in the collected works, and they're all to his hypochondria, and they're not very interesting. Kant is his actions, what he did, everything I write about in my chapter. The reason Kant's there is that's not really relevant to what makes Kant great. What makes Kant great, it's all in the books. Kant's in the book because he represents the limit of this whole idea of philosophy as a way of life, where the life vanishes into the work. And the work is really all that matters. Sort of Diogenes the Cynic's the opposite. There is no work.
Well, you can also say that about, the philosopher that kicks off not only your book but philosophy itself. Socrates, there are no writings.
True. Although Socrates is, I would say, one of the hardest problems I faced in writing the book is both a literary and a methodological problem, is that all the early guys, but particularly Socrates, they're figures of myth. They're poetic creations.
They're fictions.
They're fictions. And they're not, we have no reliable evidence. And in the case of Socrates, in a way it's even worse, because the fiction has been created by a genius artist, Plato, and it's so compelling the way he appears in the pages of many of the dialogues that people who ought to know better, who were supremely talented, erudite scholars, actually bewitch themselves into thinking they can find the real Socrates floating around somewhere in the pages of these dialogues. So,
maybe not even find it, but follow it.
Follow it. So the issue of what do you do with a character who, on the one hand, he demonstrably lived. He did go to trial, and he did die. I mean, we know that much about him, just as we know roughly that much about Jesus Christ. But apart from these kind of stark facts, the sad truth is we don't know a whole lot in detail. And the notion that there is this fictional idealization that is held out really in the hands of Plato presents an incredibly daunting standard of rational self-reflection, rational unity. It's quite extraordinary, and it's people sometimes talk about the axial age and the founding religions and compare Socrates to Confucius and Jesus or Buddha. And the thing that leaps out is what's striking in the Platonic fiction is that unlike all of these other moral teachers, Socrates, he lives an exemplary life, but one of the ways he's exemplary is he never stops arguing and trying to clarify what he believes. And so he's a paragon of endless reasoning. He's not necessarily, it's not clear that he ever came to any answers, but that makes him unique.
But it also seems that for you, one of the most difficult questions then becomes, how does one live in accordance with this idealized fictional character?
Well, the fiction of Socrates founds philosophy. He's the first philosopher. There was no the meaning of philosophy is invented out of thin air, more or less, by Plato in his portraits of Socrates. And all the first generations of subsequent philosophers, the vast majority of them, see themselves as being called upon to measure up to the example of Socrates. So if you look at Cynicism, you look at early Stoicism, it's over and over again, it's the character of Socrates. So you can't tell the story of philosophy as a way of life without starting with this character who may be too good to be true in both senses of the term.
Yeah, and that plays out throughout all of the lives of the characters in your book. But while, there are a few things we know about Socrates for sure. We know that he never founded a school, nor he never purported to be, in a non-ironic sense, a teacher of wisdom, whereas Plato teaches Dion, Aristotle tutors Alexander the Great, and Seneca gets stuck with Nero, and all three turn out to be very disappointing students.
Uh-huh.
And they, like their teachers, are even seem to be worse at sort of living according to these ideals. But for you, these stories seem to be not so much lessons for Plato, Aristotle, and Seneca, but perhaps maybe philosophy itself?
Well, you know, this, the kinds of stories, let's call them scenes of instruction, which they there is a literature about Socrates trying to teach Alcibiades, who was one of the most notorious, wily, ruthless statesmen of classical Athens. So you have in each of these cases, Socrates tries to teach Alcibiades. Alcibiades ends up going off convincing the Athenians to start the Peloponnesian War. He's accused of impieties, and he then he flees and goes to Sparta, reveals all the military secrets of Athens to Sparta. From Sparta, he flees to Persia, tells them what, you know, it's unbelievable story. And there are similar stories that were told about Plato and Dion and Dionysus in Syracuse, Sicily, Aristotle and Alexander, Seneca and Nero, obviously. But this sense of the scenes of instruction becomes a trope in antiquity, and in Plutarch's Lives of the Greek and Roman statesmen, many of the chapters will actually have what I sometimes call a philosopher buddy for the statesman. And the way in which philosophy enters into and a conversation with politics is primarily, for a couple thousand years, not political philosophy, as I thought. I was taught political theory. It's through these stories that are told about the human interactions between rulers with absolute power and the philosophers who are often shown struggling, usually unsuccessfully, to get these tyrants to limit their power through force of reason and persuasion.
So it's not so much a warning then to the mixing of politics and philosophy, but something else?
I think that for 2,000 years, it was gentlemen were taught that before you could rule over others, you needed to know how to rule over yourself, and philosophy was the art of ruling yourself. And therefore, it was considered one of the things that made philosophers' lives of interest was precisely these moments of instruction, which often are failures, and you can learn both from negative as well as positive examples. And that in the classical curriculum for 2,000 years, that's one reason why these stories were important. And I know it's very alien to us today, given our sort of democratic prejudices and our expectation that philosophers, you know, particularly if you take the cartoon version of Socrates as a paragon of absolute pristine integrity, that how could he ever get mixed up in this kind of stuff? And the ancient sources, of course, struggle with that. And the answer, I think, is a little disingenuous, is that Alcibiades was bewitched by demagoguery. The people loved him, and, you know, Socrates loved him, but the love of Socrates couldn't compete with the love of the people, the worship of this demagogue. And so it's the fault of the people of Athens that he didn't listen to Socrates. It's not Socrates' fault.
The one story that really jumps out that isn't like the others is, of course, the encounter between Diogenes and Alexander. And this story really resonates, I think, in, you know, set up the way you do with the other ones. Can you tell that story and just what is so radically different there?
Well, Diogenes is a—he's a strange case because more radically than Socrates, you know, basically we don't have even fictional arguments as we do in Plato's dialogues and to some extent in Xenophon. We basically have one-liners. He's like the Henny Youngman of antiquity or something. But he's always portrayed as being supremely indifferent to this temptation of being an instructor to the powerful. And So there's a set of anecdotes that circulate in antiquity. One of the most famous ones is Alexander has come from Macedon, and he's passing through Corinth, which happens to be where Diogenes is. He would split his time between Corinth and Athens, and he's apparently in his clay tub, which is what passes for a residence because he's very ascetic. He has few wants or needs, and he tries to live as simply as possible. Alexander comes to visit him because he's both intrigued by and slightly irritated by the fact that Diogenes has not come to pay him court, basically, whereas all the other teachers and philosophers around have done that.
They're lined up.
And so, but he goes to Diogenes, and Diogenes is sitting there in the sun, and Alexander says, approaches him, and Diogenes looks up at Alexander and says, "Could you please move? You're blocking the sunlight." This sense of someone who is serenely indifferent to the vagaries, the temptations of power, worldly power, Alexander becomes a bit player in that. And it's completely the opposite with Aristotle and Alexander, since Aristotle tutors Alexander.
What do you feel was the lesson from that story?
Well, it's not entirely clear because Diogenes, many of the things that he is purported to have done, like urinated in public or taken a crap in public, bark like a dog, would seem to be things that would earn opprobrium from a fairly traditional religious society. But the opposite was the case. I mean, Diogenes was memorialized and beloved. He was never put on trial, and later cynics were treated almost like Hare Krishna beggars. They were a kind of public, but not quite like Hare Krishna beggars in the sense that they were, I think, tolerated better. It's almost like they were court fools occasionally, and they were seen as representing some alternative available for only a few within the community that the rest of the community was willing to support for reasons that are not entirely clear to me. But the real influence of cynicism, ironically, I think, is in the rise of monasticism, where you have a codified set of people who live a completely different life that is cordoned off from the regular society, and they live on, you know, bread and water and way far removed from the luxuries of ordinary society. And somehow the society sees them as moral exemplars that they're willing, in effect, to support. Because, you know, monks and cynics, I mean, they're both parasites on society. They don't do anything productive. They just sit there and pray or, you know, come up with one-liners like Diogenes.
So two of the philosophers in your book, Augustine and Rousseau, actually write books they call Confessions. And, you know, the two men are from different times and they have very different philosophical projects. And Rousseau's insistence on a natural goodness of man almost makes it pointless to almost compare the two, being that Augustine is steeped in original sin. But both of these men do seem to feel the need later on in their life to justify certain criticisms of inconsistencies, sort of the inability at times to live up to what were almost divine moments of inspiration for both, and in Augustine's case, actual divine.
Actual divine, he says blithely. How do we know? How do you know? Well, obviously, Rousseau's Confessions is titled after Augustine's book. Augustine's book, as originally presented, confession at the time would have meant confiding to God in a way that will confirm the glory of God. It's not an act that was codified in any form of ritual penance as it came to be in the latter Catholic Church. But in the case of Augustine, there's a very specific issue, it seems to me, he's trying to confront. And what makes it's an incredible, great book. But one of the specific political problems it's trying to address is that Augustine had been a pretty well-known figure in public circles in North Africa, Rome, Milan, which is where he circulated during his lifetime. And he first came to prominence as someone who was a follower of Manichaeanism, which was there were both pagan and monotheistic versions of Manichaeanism, but it took a very dualistic view that the world was riven between good and evil, and there was a cosmic struggle between the two that is not consonant with standard issue Christianity. But it was as a Manichaean that he made his way from the provinces to Rome and then to Milan as a speechwriter, as an orator of some considerable prominence. And then once he was in Milan, he successively explored a variety of other different types of philosophies and was briefly and became a quite ardent follower of the Neoplatonic philosopher Plotinus. He set up a little community of friends that they fancied themselves living in Platonopolis, and they would go on strolls and discuss the good life and so on and so forth. And they were trying to Plotinus was a mystic, and he was really trying to cultivate out-of-body experiences as a way of summoning revelations that could convert the soul and orient it properly to the sublime transcendental form of the good, the beautiful, and so forth. Eventually, Augustine decides that Neoplatonism isn't the right path, and that the right path is to be found in Christianity and in Christian scripture.
This was an epiphany moment for him.
Famous, conversion scene in the garden recounted in the Confessions. Anyway, he ends up getting baptized, which in those days you could do as an adult, and that would symbolize a real serious commitment to the religion. And he ends up, assuming a life of chastity. He goes back to North Africa. He ends up being a bishop. Now, as a bishop, he's surrounded by people who are very suspicious of him, and the rumors are spreading around that, this guy was a Manichaean, he was a Platonist, actually he likes pagan philosophy, he's not one of us. And there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. The Confessions was written to sort of quell that kind of rumor. And the way he does it is pioneering, because what he does is he crafts a coherent narrative story where he's able to take these moments of spiritual errancy and integrate them into an overarching narrative arc that leads, as the goal, the telos of the whole story, it keeps coming back to discovering that the true self he's in search of throughout this time inside himself is God. And that the God that he has discovered is the God that was announced by the Messiah, Jesus Christ. So he can essentially say, yes, I stole pears, I was, I was a womanizer, I dabbled in all these different forms of heretical thinking, and they were stations on my path to become what I am. Thank God I've discovered who I truly am, and that I confess all of this errancy to you, my God. You know that I went through this path. I know I will undoubtedly continue to stray, but because you're my rock inside of me. So it's a very disarming rejoinder, and it's in the form of a autobiographical story that manages to make consistent and coherent what might just seem contradictory. Yeah.
So when Rousseau set out to write his Confessions, he had a much more difficult task. He had these stories about the illegitimate children that he had given to the orphanage. Was there something in the success of what Augustine did that inspired him to sort of call his work Confessions, sort of set out on a similar narrative path, or was he just cribbing the title?
Well, I think he's obviously cribbing the title in a way that's quite immodest. Secondly, Rousseau had gone back and forth between Calvinism and Catholicism, so he sort of he would have been aware with the aware of the Catholic institution of confession as a form of penance. So Rousseau's confessions are penitential in a way, and they are they're extraordinary because he. Augustine, there's a lot that's allegorical. You know, who knows if he really stole pears, but it's an episode that's redolent of the Garden of Eden, and you know, there's a lot of symbolic stuff in Augustine. Whereas in Rousseau, he basically decides the project seems to be very Protestant in the sense that you're going to put on the printed page everything, particularly everything that would seem discreditable. So there's a whole bunch of episodes in the confessions that the only way we know about them is because they're in the confessions. Montaigne did this before Rousseau, so that's one model. But, you know, the fact that Rousseau had a kind of sadomasochistic streak, that there's these homoerotic encounters that he has, there's this kind of very strange, perverse relationship he has with the woman 13 years older than him who he calls Mama, that he likes spanking. You know, there's all this stuff that's out there. But the main, you know, thing, the thorn in his side, is the fact that he had given all of the children he had out of wedlock to an orphanage in Paris.
Which meant certain death, as you write, at the time.
Well,
or most likely a death.
Yeah, because these were, on the one hand, it was a normative institution in 18th century France. Lots of people did this. And Rousseau, in his defense, says, hey, lots of people did this. Not much of a defense. He also tries to say, well, Plato in the Republic said you should give children to be reared collectively. So it's all what, you know, in a pejorative sense, I would call rationalizations. But the whole idea of laying out everything blameworthy in your life for all to see, to render yourself transparent, in Rousseau's case, it's as if Augustine, as I say, is always addressing himself to God. Whereas Rousseau clearly is addressing himself to secular readers. And so the eye of God has been changed by the public opinion, basically. And it's a very paradoxical thing to say, show how terrible you are and hope that people will have sympathy for you, which in 18th century France, it worked. When the book was published posthumously, it's a huge bestseller. People wept about it. They felt so bad for poor Rousseau. So, you know, the paradox of a memoir that relates in gripping detail all these horrible, perverse things you did. I guess he's a way station towards a genre that I find deplorable in modern-day publishing, but that's another story.
So the last two philosophers in your book are Emerson and Nietzsche. And something really jumps out when you put Emerson next to Nietzsche.
Well, I wanted to do Emerson next to Nietzsche because as I was taught and I learned years ago from Stanley Cavell, a philosopher I admire, Nietzsche owes a lot to Emerson. And I got sick and tired of, you know, college kids coming to talk to me about Nietzsche as if this was this wild man who was somehow immune from main currents of American thought, and I thought it was amusing that it was pretty demonstrable that Emerson was this major influence on Nietzsche, as important as Schopenhauer or Montaigne or what have you. But they pair up pretty well because both of them come out of religious families. They're both creatures of this Protestant imperative to know thyself, and they're both rebel against it in different ways. I think both of them understood that the invocation to tell everything and show everything about yourself is it has a potential to make you feel endlessly lousy because you feel guilty all the time about all the bad stuff you've done. I mean, which was sort of the point for Luther. I mean, he wanted people to feel sinful, and that was preparatory to becoming appropriately humble and turning towards God. So you had both of them, in the case of Emerson's family, the Congregationalist preachers, in the case of Nietzsche's father, his family, Lutheran ministers. And The way in which they both take somewhat different paths to basically leaving the church behind, but not leaving behind, I don't think, the calling of ministering to the people and of bringing glad tidings, so that Emerson becomes a kind of a secular preacher, a prophetic preacher in America, on the whole lecture circuit, lecturing, you know, half of the year, traveling around the country, hugely successful, makes money doing it, appears on stages that would be shared with P.T. Barnum. And I do believe that on some level, Nietzsche aspired to this, and it made him crazy. He was crazy for other reasons, but it made him crazy that he could not reach the audience he wanted. And I think there's a deep wish, which is most lyrically communicated and ambivalently communicated in the character, the fictional character of Zarathustra, who is a preacher and preaching a new gospel.
But for Emerson, you know, these successes that he eventually goes on to, there were difficult moments on the way there, and as there were for Nietzsche. That, I mean, it seems that not only do their paths diverge early on in life, but there's also, there are moments of struggle for Emerson that he is able to successfully work through where Nietzsche is not.
That's right. Well, in the case of Emerson, he was essentially excommunicated from Harvard. Oh, terrible fate, but it was for him, because the Congregationalist divines were horrified at the kind of romantic drivel, in their view, that he had was coming up with as a substitute for Christianity, and so he did have to struggle and make his way, but he found an audience in his own lifetime and was a huge success, whereas Nietzsche, in his rational, lucid lifetime, was nothing of the sort. I mean, he only began to be taken seriously within the first years after his descent into paralysis and silence, in the final 10 years of his syphilitic paralysis.
So when you put these two together, then, what are some of the lessons that you feel resonate further on into our time?
Well, here I feel like I'm drawn up short, and I'm a little ambivalent, because on the one hand, I wrote this book because I feel like this is a genealogy of a tradition that shaped me and I can't escape from. And I still feel like I've made my way in the world by constantly trying to think about, who am I? What can I do that nobody else could do? It's a sense of vocation, of a calling. And it's something that I inherited to some extent. I'm sure I try to imbue it in my children and in my students. On the other hand, I find it very puzzling, because if I look at the lives actually led by Rousseau or Emerson or Nietzsche, in antiquity, the whole reason to lead an examined life for many of these philosophers was they thought it would give you serenity, tranquility, it would make you happy. But when I look at the lives that were actually lived by Nietzsche and Rousseau, they're pretty miserable. And it turns out to be sometimes tormenting to try to be honest with yourself about who you really are. Americans want and will respond to edification. They want somebody to say, here's your 12-step plan about how you can have a happy life. And it seems to me, if you take seriously the notion of living an examined life, edification is not what's on offer here. It just isn't. Would I want my life to be unexamined? No way. But does this a recipe for happiness? I don't think so. And the more seriously you take this and the further you go, it's a risky and interesting adventure if you take this seriously.
You end with a quote from Pastor Rick Warren. Can you maybe talk about, read it and what it means for you?
Well, I end in the following way, which I, many of my reviewers, some of the critics, really have. There's a review that actually on Amazon.com that's hilarious that claims that I'm endorsing Rick Warren in the conclusion of the book, which wasn't my intention. Look, I mean, there.
Can you read the quote?
Yeah, the quote is. You won't discover your life's meaning by looking within yourself. You didn't create yourself, so there is no way you can tell yourself what you were created for. This is from one of Rick Warren's best-selling books on, the purpose-driven life or whatever he calls these things. What I wanted to say, I'm saying something completely the opposite of what Dreyfus and Kelly are saying in their best-selling book. They claim we live in a secular age and the world has lost meaning. I think that's ridiculous. I think that most Americans actually believe in God. It's not, for most people, a secular age. Monotheism is alive and well. It's available to people as one option of how to live. And if what you want is meaning in life and happiness, and I don't mean this facetiously, going and studying philosophy and really examining yourself, you know, you're probably better off if you just, you know, sign up with a church and, you know, become part of it. That's available. And to me, there's nothing wrong with that. It's not my way, but it's an available way. And the other thing I say in the conclusion is if you really want to understand the way the world really is, which was one of the things philosophers historically have wanted to understand, well, then modern academic philosophy, it has a lot to say for itself. I mean, because the scruples of analytic philosophy, conceptual clarification, philosophy of science, there's a lot we can learn from that. So, this is not a book written to just say, wow, this is the way, this will solve all your problems, because I don't think that's where philosophy started, and I don't think it's where it ends, what they thought they knew. Much of what he seems to have done is to rattle people so they lacked self-confidence when all was said and done. And in some sense, I actually think that is the proper role of philosophy much of the time.
You know, I know this isn't facetious for you because we met 15 years ago. I was 22 years old, and I had one dream in life, which was to come and study Nietzsche and Kierkegaard with you at the New School. And I flew all the way from Montana, first visit to New York City, and I spent the day touring the school, and then I was in your office, and you pretty much told me this. You said you actually brought up a student that I reminded you of that you felt had gotten incredibly sad, very unhappy from the study of philosophy, and you basically said, you were very frank, that you felt perhaps maybe this wouldn't work out for me. And I know you've already told me you don't remember the encounter, but it was obviously a very important one for me. But when I left your office, I remember walking around Washington Square Park, and I was in tears. I was very upset. But I realized that at that point, I had only considered that the only way to study philosophy would be to go to graduate school and do that. Whereas you had pointed out, it's not like you have to stop reading. It's not like you can stop exploring and asking these questions. And 7 years later, many of my friends were literally on the verge of mental breakdown and financial destitution thanks to grad school. And I felt like I had won. And I always wanted to say thank you. And I feel really lucky to get to do that here today.
Oh, well, thank you.
Thank you. This episode of Too Much Information is called The Philosophical Life. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen. Thanks once again to James Miller. You can find more information about the program on the TMI playlist page at WFMU.org, and that's where you can subscribe to the TMI podcast as well. Also, I'm finally ready to build the website for TMI, but I could use some help. So if you have an idea of what a futuristic radio show website should look like or how it should work, drop me a line.
All suggestions are welcome and appreciated.
Two upcoming philosophy events worth mentioning. This Wednesday you can catch James Miller at the New School on West 12th Street. He is part of a panel discussion on why philosophy matters today. And then next Sunday, January the 30th, at the Greenlight Bookstore in Brooklyn, Benjamin Walker discusses fiction and philosophy on a panel discussion that is part of the Walls and Bridges Festival. There are links to both of these events on the Too Much Information webpage. You are listening to WFMU East Orange, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Up next, Mud Up with DJ Rupture.
In the rain, tears never green. When you see down and see that, and see that, and every day of the day,
Upon the high, let's see.